we have
it. They don't have their
call the Thursday, March 29th meeting of the House Transportation Finance Committee to order. You get a day off, Johnson. There's no minutes today, so save yourself for the next time.
Okay.
Thank you for being here today. The first bill of the on the agenda is House File 4160. It's my bill,
sure.
And we're going to lay that over. So
sure.
I'm going to ask staff to explain the bill. Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chairman, members, House File 4160 has a couple of changes, including a fair amount of technical changes. Actually, in a sense, the entirety of the bill is technical. So this involves the driver and vehicle services operating accounts and the technology surcharge and the technology account that has funded MNLARS. So sections 1, 2, and 6 of the bill remove language that has now expired that had established a surcharge on various driver licensing and other transaction types like motor vehicle registration and titling. This was a surcharge that had been in place and then was extended and has since expired, ended at the end of fiscal 16. So these would be technical changes to eliminate the language from the statutes. And then section 3, in conjunction with the revisor's instruction, would establish a new fund, a driver and vehicle services fund, and move the two operating accounts for driver and vehicle services, as well as the technology account, into that fund. And then there are some other technical and conforming changes. That's the entirety of the bill, Mr. Chair. I can answer further questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Burris. Is there a fiscal note on this bill?
Mr. Chair, members, no, there's not. This bill essentially moves accounts around, but it doesn't require the agency to spend money or change revenues or fees.
Thank you. Any questions on House File 4160? Seeing none, this bill is laid over for possible inclusion. Next we have House File 3703, Representative Barr.
This is vehicle. This is vehicle bill. Will you come back?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I will move House File 3703 be passed to Ways and Means. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3703 would require MnDOT to modify its Highway Investment Plan or MnSHIP Fund to prioritize handling congestion in the metro area. Minnesota's 12,000-mile state highway plays a key role in our economy and quality of life. Currently, only $240 million over 20 years is earmarked for mobility or congestion relief. Meanwhile, in his state address, Governor Dayton said, another crucial area for infrastructure investments is in transportation. Everyone driving in our state knows that traffic congestion and highway conditions keep getting worse, wasting their time and straining their sanity. And I do agree with the governor on that statement. This legislation would require MnDOT to allocate funds that are sufficient to have an impact on congestion. Currently, user fee lanes are prioritized over general purpose lanes. More recently, there has been discussion in committee around implementing toll roads broadly throughout the Twin Cities, which would contribute to congestion. That's why it's critical that MnDOT build requirements in the MnSHIP plan and incorporate those requirements into the statewide multimodal transportation plan. Mr. Chair, I did have a testifier who couldn't be here today, so I would like to just share some statistics and information from her presentation. From her, it's Kim Crockett's presentation from the Center of the American Experiment, and a couple of things that Ms. Crockett pointed out in prior committee was that since 2010, MnDOT's strategy has shifted from reducing congestion toward providing alternatives to congested travel. And some of those alternatives include bikes, pedestrian paths, and light rail trains. I don't know about any of you, but when I think of a hockey mom, I'm not convinced that those alternatives would be helpful in the middle of winter here in Minnesota. Also, declining commitment to congestion relief. In 2009, 6.9% of the budget was dedicated to congestion relief. In 2013, 3.5% was dedicated. And in 2017, only 1.1% of the budget was dedicated to congestion relief. So the focus really has shifted away from reducing congestion. In the Twin Cities, we have four of the 100 worst bottlenecks in the country. And I believe two of them are in the top 10. And with that, I would also comment that in their investment direction handout that we've received previously, I'm sorry, I don't have the exact, it's the 20-year Minnesota State Highway Investment Plan. They also talk about that plan is focused solely on existing maintenance, and they talk about the fact that, let me just find it here, that in the Twin Cities with regards to mobility, that they say the projected outcomes over time are that travel time reliability is going to decrease. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative. We do have an amendment. Would you like to get your bill amended to get it in the shape you would like?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the A1 amendment.
Thank you. The author moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape she would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Your bill is amended. We have a testifier from MnDOT registered. Please come forward and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Mark Kieske. I'm the director of the Office of Transportation System Management at MnDOT. And I have a few comments about the bill and what the impact would be on the program. First of all, the investment direction that's contained in the Minnesota State Highway Investment Plan was accomplished over a number of months, including a lot of time spent with stakeholders and members of the public to find out what it was that they would like us to do in terms of priorities for investment in the highway system. The result of that is what's in the plan. So taking care of our existing infrastructure was a priority for the public and stakeholders. This would override that and change that priority. With our current resources and the need to preserve Minnesota's aging transportation system over the next 20 years, we are planning to spend well over 70% of our capital revenue on repairing or replacing bridges and pavements. That adds up to something over $14 billion in 20 years. In our current MnSHIP, we did analyze some other situations, some other kinds of investment strategies. We did look at a scenario where we invested enough money in Twin Cities mobility to accomplish some of the goals that had been set by the Metro District and by the Met Council. That goal included adding capacity, currently in the form of MinPass lanes, on 10 corridors, making 20 to 24 spot mobility improvements. Again, this is over 20 years, so a little over one a year. Only two or three larger investments, such as expanding or rebuilding interchanges and adding technology to another 10 miles of the corridors. Doing that adds up to about $4.7 billion. So that's a number to keep in mind as we consider this bill and the amendment that has been passed. So currently, if you look at the condition of our bridges and pavements, less than 3% of the trunk highway pavements and bridges are in poor condition. If we were to implement this bill and invest the money accordingly, the resulting decrease in our pavement investments would result in something over 20 to 30% poor pavements at the end of 20 years and something over 20% of poor bridges in 20 years. That's if we took the money uniformly from across the state. With the amendment, the way it was passed, and only diverting the money from the Metro District, in the next 10 years, the Metro District is expected to have about $2 billion to spend on preservation. So in 20 years, they'd have about $4 billion. And the scenario that we just talked about with the 20 to 24 spot improvements and all of those, it costs $4.7 billion. would take all the money that's being planned for system preservation in the Metro District for the next 20 years and then some. So it would be devastating to the condition of the pavements and the bridges in the Metro District. Then one final comment on the bill. It does remove MinPass as an option for addressing congestion. MinPass is one of our key strategies for improving the efficiency of the region's highway and transit systems by providing a reliable, congestion-free option for commuters during peak travel times. A single MinPass lane carries twice as many people as a single general-purpose lane during peak hour congestion. Buses and commuters that use the MinPass lanes can rely on a 50 to 55 mile per hour trip while they're traveling in that lane. And then outside of the peak travel times, the MinPass lanes are used as general purpose lanes, which is something over 90% of the time. And with that, that's the end of my comments.
Thank you. Question from Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I read this bill right, no, Representative Barr, there's no increase in funding. We're just taking the existing dollars and shifting them around. And as we heard from the MnDOT, going to be taking out of money for preservation of roads and bridges. I think the analogy here, usually the analogy is just we're just rearranging the deck chairs on a sinking ship. But in this case, we're just rearranging the traffic cones on a falling bridge, Mr. Chair. Without any more money into it, it's making the situation worse.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Rundbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank Representative Barr for bringing this bill. I mean, I think some of the reality we live with is that we may have to look for higher valued ways to spend the current monies that we have, shifting from lower value to higher value. But I think a point that I'd like to make, and I'm sure a lot of folks on the committee aren't aware, that currently the ratio of transportation funding in the metro is 3-to-1 transit over metro highways. So we are spending, and this is projected over the next 10 years, and does not include some of the proposed light rail spending. So it's three times what we're spending or projected to spend on transit versus metro highways. So when you calculate that only 4% of folks are using transit, the investment is really disproportional and needs correction. So thank you. Thanks for bringing the bill, Representative.
Representative Bernardi.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to ask Mr. Gieske a question about how, I mean, I'm really concerned about that this is a gimmick looking like there's more transportation funding, and I'm concerned that we can't even maintain the system we currently have, and this is expanding the system, so we can't take care of what we have. We're going to grow it more and then not have money to maintain that. So, I mean, it's just more crumbling roadways, in my opinion. So I'm going to ask you, how does this impact MAP 21 and FAST Act requirements for performance measures? If you're not maintaining the system you have now, what could that impact be on the state of Minnesota and their federal funding?
Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the FAST Act has requirements in it for certain levels of performance in maintaining the bridges and the pavements. If we fail to meet the required performance levels, the FHWA would have the ability to compel us to redirect the spending of our money. And certainly 20 to 30% poor pavements would greatly exceed the allowable amount of poor pavements that they would have. So, in effect, there would be some direction given to us by the federal government to change our spending.
President Bernardi.
So, that's interesting. So it would be in conflict to what the legislature is directing. The federal government would rule. Let's say you didn't follow that. Would you lose federal funding?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Gieske,
members of the committee, the way the federal rule is written right now, it doesn't penalize us by taking money away. It simply takes away our flexibility to use the money for other things than whatever, whatever the performance areas that we're not achieving.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, if I understand correctly, this bill would be in conflict of you meeting the federal requirements to keep your pavements in a certain amount of condition. This would not allow you to do that.
Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, ultimately we would not be able to achieve the required targets.
Thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Gieske, I know that earlier in your testimony you talked about a little over $4 billion cost figure to do this particular bill as amended. I'm failing to kind of really understand how you arrived at that. Could you give us a little bit more clarity about what analysis you used in order to get to that figure over the 20-year period?
Mr. Gieske.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. When we did the State Highway Investment Plan, we looked at different funding levels for each type of investment category that we have in the plan. One of those is Twin Cities Mobility. Others are bridges and pavements and safety, and we have several different categories. So for each category, they looked at least 3 to 4, sometimes 5 different funding levels to try and understand what kind of performance we would achieve at each of those funding levels. So the highest level that they evaluated for Twin Cities Mobility was the situation that I described. Exactly what that would achieve in terms of delayed increase in congestion, I'm not sure, or if it would satisfy the conditions of the bill to make an appreciable reduction in congestion. I don't have a number on what it would do for that, but to accomplish those, they looked at the number of projects that would include and did a rough estimate on what those projects would cost and came up with a total of $4.7
billion. Representative Petersburg, a follow-up?
Yeah, just one follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Gieske, for letting us know that this really a kind of a supposition and basically a best guess, which is really what this bill really asks for, is to establish that particular priority and look at the figures that are there. And because you weren't necessarily directed that way before, you may get different results this time. And so I'm just a little cautious about throwing around a number in which you really weren't directed to go in this particular route and saying that's the number that's going to be, because it indeed may not be. And included in that could also be some of the preservation projects that you might need, could also improve congestion. And so there's kind of an issue there where I think we need to be cautious and careful that we include all of the expenses that are there, which I think this bill will at least help us direct that figure, in my opinion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for Mr. Gieske. You had mentioned that pavement, 3% of our pavement is now substandard, and it could potentially go up to 30%. What are some ways that our motoring public would see this? How would it be manifested? Would we see more potholes? Would we see bridges that might be closed or increased in fracture critical? Would we see some, you know, less guardrails and safety kinds of things? What are some specific things that the motoring public might notice if those numbers go up to that degree?
Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so some of the things you'd notice for pavement, the definition of poor pavement is determined by taking input from the public and on when they feel pavements are uncomfortable or unsafe. And so those are levels that the public has identified as it's too rough, it's uncomfortably rough. It's certainly a level of roughness that freight carriers would be concerned about damaging their goods. So yes, probably more potholes, extreme kinds of maintenance would need to be done to keep the pavement together. With bridges, likely that could be an outcome, that there might be some posted or restricted bridges if there wasn't money to keep them in shape. It would divert money away from some of the other kinds of investments that we don't have quite the same ability to predict or measure, but all the roadside infrastructure, if the money went to mobility, wouldn't be available for the guardrail improvements, for the lighting and the signing, for the safety projects. So you would see deteriorated conditions in all of those kinds of assets.
Follow-up, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. And then yesterday we heard a bill about increasing sound barriers, noise. Would that also be potentially impacted by this?
Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. Any roadside asset would be included in that roadside infrastructure category, which was included in the numbers that I gave for the amount that we're spending on preservation. So all of those would be affected by diverting the money to mobility kind of investments.
And so, Mr. Chair, we have restrictions on bridges, more potholes, not enough lighting, less guardrails, less noise barriers. I don't see how this is going to be helpful to our highway system at all. Thank you.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mainly a few comments. It amazes me about how many ways that the data that has been presented to this committee has been interpreted in different ways. What I remember last year is when MnDOT came here, they made it very, very clear that they were trying their best to just work on preservation and maintenance because they do not have enough money. And then to have a bill that comes along that wants to redo a major study, to me, is an incredible amount of wasted money that should be going to working on our infrastructure. I truly don't understand that at all. I mean, you have a study. The problem is we don't have enough money. And again, I'll repeat, MnDOT does not have enough money. They haven't had enough money for 20 years. We need to come up with long-term funding. That's where we should be focusing, not on telling them 50 different ways to distracting them from what their main priorities are. Thank you. I'm a little frustrated.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The line that I find particularly bewildering is line 11. So we're directing MnDOT to allocate sufficient funds to achieve an appreciable reduction in congestion compared to anticipated congestion levels. Given the fact that that's our role, it is bewildering where MnDOT will come up with sufficient funds. It sounds like they have got to sort of create what normally is our responsibility to pass a budget for. So that one is a particularly bewildering line. Kim Crockett quotes Randall O'Toole as the basis for this bill. And I can remember going to National Transportation Conferences a long time ago. He was recognized as this ideologue who has never had to run a Department of Transportation and comes up with lines like trains cause congestion. Those national conferences would actually have a workshop titled Answering Randall O'Toole. But he was recognized nationally as an ideologue who simply had to be dealt with. I mean, this was a problem that other states shared. So the outcome of the sort of dizzying amount of multiple micromanaging bills that we have seen recently leave us with no clear sense of how that department would accomplish line 11, allocate sufficient funds. It's like creating money out of the air, apparently.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Gieske, I failed to clarify one other assumption. Basically, your assumptions on the cost of this project is based upon no additional funding, no additional prioritizing changes, et cetera, no additional dollars from the federal government as well. So these projections are truly based upon what we're doing today and nothing in the future. Is that correct?
Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's based upon the revenues that we would collect from the current funding sources. So it does estimate that the amount of revenue from the current taxes would increase by some amount, but it does not assume any new taxes. It doesn't assume any new bonding bills. It assumes just a historical rate of increase in the federal funds, and I would say also it doesn't include any Corridors of Commerce program in any of these numbers that I've given.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. Mr. Gieske, just as a final question, do you think that some of those assumptions, especially in Corridors of Commerce money, could also be included into the future if we were to go through with this particular bill?
Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's certainly likely that something will change in 20 years, that there'll be different funding than exists right now, but the requirement for the State Highway Investment Plan is that it look only at currently available funding sources.
Thank you. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to mention that the point I was making earlier is illustrated in the two pieces that are being handed out. It's a 10-year prospective look at the funding for transit in the Twin Cities and a prospective 10-year look out at metro highway funding. And so it's about 3-to-1, $1.1 billion for transit and about $350 million or $400 million a year to the metro highways. And to me, they get a lot of bang for that buck. I mean, they're doing an incredible job maximizing those dollars and creating a great highway system. So something's wrong in the formula. We need to address. So thank you.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Barr, for the bill. And Mr. Gieske, I'm looking at 174.01, which the bill references, and it sounds like some of the things in there, there's 16 different items in here that's called out in that section of statute, giving directions to the department on the types of activities generally that they should be in. And as I read Representative Barr's bill, it looks like she is asking the department to reprioritize their efforts in some of those areas in order to accommodate this 20-year construction plan redo that will help to actually move people within the metro area. And as I read this, Mr. Gieske, item number 5 in 174.01 says to encourage tourism by providing appropriate transportation, etc. Number 13, to increase use of transit as a percentage of all trips statewide. 14, to promote and increase bicycling and walking. And it goes on to describe that. Number 15, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the state's transportation sector. 16, to accomplish these goals with minimal impact on the environment. Sounds like maybe those would be some that might be deprioritized in order to bring forward the priority expressed in this bill. Is that what you would understand, Mr. Gieske?
Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, if you change the priorities of spending, it would probably change the relative outcomes that would have been achieved for some of those goals. I can't say specifically how that would affect each goal, but it would certainly be a significant change that one would expect that would be different outcomes.
So, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Gieske, and Representative Barr, members, I support this bill. I think when Minnesotans see that we are making an effort to bring prioritization to the funds that are already available within the transportation area that they are paying taxes for each and every day, they will appreciate Representative Barr's bill and the effort going forward here so that we can prioritize actually moving people instead of some of these things that truly appear to be distractions that have been written into law over time and need correction among the priority. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered, I'm familiar with this argument about transit spending, and I'm not sure it's accurate. I thought maybe, I know that Mr. Lee might not be able to have the figures at his fingertips now, but I wonder if you could provide, maybe at some future date, to the committee, a breakdown of how much we spend on roads versus transit in the metro area. And, there's all sorts of pots of money. You know, we have property taxes for local roads and all sorts of things. So I don't want you to do a master's thesis or anything like that, but, maybe a thumbnail sketch might be useful because I think, we can pick and choose data however we want to use it and come up with conclusions, but I really trust House fiscal staff on this. And if it's possible to, because I don't think this is at all accurate and comprehensive. So if that's possible, Mr. Chair, that might be useful. Doesn't have to, I'm not giving them a due date, I'm not, but some sort of real analysis of
how much we spend on transit versus roads would be useful to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. We'll try and gather some information for a future hearing.
Mr. Chair? Sorry.
Representative Van Beck.
And not to prolong this exactly, but are you thinking that the highway spending is more than 350 or 400 million
well,
a year, or that transit is
If you take all of the different pots of money we use for roads and transit, and you calculate local roads, you calculate federal money, invest all sorts of things, I don't think it's the number that's being advertised. But you know, I want to just verify that.
All right. Yeah, those are the questions I asked the fiscal agent as well. So,
yeah.
And verified by Metro District, Mr. McBride, we spend about $400 million each year, and that includes corridors of commerce and all the different kinds of other pots of money that are going for. But it's not local road money. No, this is talking about our major thoroughfares, highways and freeways.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and from what I have known in the past, and I'm not sure, but Mr. Geiske, is this money that they're saying is on transit that we get from the federal government, can we switch that over and use it on roads? Or is that money, if we don't use it on transit, goes away? And so then we're not only are we not helping the problem, making it worse because there's less money in the system.
Mr. Geiske.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to the best of my knowledge, all of that money that comes through FTA for transit in Minnesota is only available for transit and can't be diverted to highways.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
So, Mr. Chair, so what I suppose was right, that if we don't spend that federal money on transit, we're not going to be able to just switch it over and build more roads with it because it's not allowed for that. It'll go elsewhere. So when we start looking at these numbers and comparing transit spending to highway spending, and if we just think, well, we're going to just move this money over, that's not going to happen because that money goes away if we don't spend it on transit.
Thank you. I have no more questions. Representative Barr, thank you for bringing this important issue forward. Obviously, we've had a lively discussion. I'd like to thank the members for their input. These are not easy questions to answer, but the prioritization of how we utilize our resources is certainly a critical question, and you're asking that question with this bill. I renew my motion that House File 3703 be passed to Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Barr.
And just one clarification as amended, correct?
Yes, I'm sorry about
Thank
that.
You.
Your bill, as amended, has been passed to Ways and Means. Thank you, members. I'm slipping, Clark. It's been a long... Yeah, it's Thursday. All right. Next up we have...
Thank you.
House File 3261, Representative Miller.
Oh, my gosh.
Representative Miller, we are not meeting in the Rathskeller.
Well, they're not meant to be open, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Lomer.
I lost.
Thank you for the time here today, Mr. Chair. I have a bill I'll present that I believe will make Representative Hornstein smile. See,
Thank
look
you.
At that. He smiled right there.
Thank you, Representative Miller. I would move that House File 3261 be passed to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yep, and I pre-ran the technology, and it should work just fine. I'd like to, if I could, show about 3.5 minutes of a video. My testifiers could not be here. This is a video that was done about them. So as soon as I bring it up, we will play that, and then I will continue on. We have a unique situation, Mr. Chair, in Greater Minnesota with agritourism, where we have these wineries, farm wineries that have grown. And as they've grown, they've become a very popular tourist spot and for the locals to come by. And they've created some challenges. Don't ever try and type a password in while you're talking. There we go. So I'd just like to pay my testifiers who own a business out in Arena, Clark City, are running into a unique challenge. Could not be here. This is a story on their business.
basically a kind of local, more social establishment that's been created out here in the last 5 years. Our point was to give people someplace to go that wasn't a chain restaurant, that wasn't a local bar, just a different atmosphere all in general. And we've done that by creating our own wines, doing kind of our own food menu, and also bringing in local entertainment, which has kind of disappeared in these regions in the last decade.
Being located in a rural community, it's own little niche thing. We found that we've had to not look at what the normal research says. Being in, say, a big town like Minneapolis, you can do a lot of variety of things, but you're going to have to do it to a mass market. Whereas around here, we have to go according to what people around here want, not just what we want.
What makes us unique to other wineries in the state of Minnesota, we are on a working farm in a rural community. We're adjacent to the vineyard. A lot of wineries, you don't see that. You're either not allowed to go out by it, or you really don't see how they function together in one entity the way they do out here. The bulk of what we do out here is grown here, is processed here, is bottled here. The furthest a bottle of wine travels out here when you drink it is maybe a quarter of a mile. You know, the furthest vine is a quarter of a mile that direction.
So we first started doing the winery just the tasting room. We expected it to be some great thing that everybody was going to come out and see, and definitely we needed to add more. So we ended up starting like a food trailer. We started really just with some flatbread pizzas, and that evolved into having a full menu and learning. Well, there's a reason why chain restaurants have an evolving menu every so many weeks. You need people to constantly see those change so they come back and see it again.
We're kind of lucky where we're at. We live very close to local pork production, local beef production, local bison production. So we do a lot of actual bison products out here. Things that you wouldn't see on a normal menu, but they're not out of people's comfort zone. That's kind of a trick, is take a food that's common and make it just uncomfortable enough and then scale it back a little bit.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I won't play the rest of the video right now. I do want to mention also that Eric and Anthony, the owners of this establishment, they are young farmers who moved back out into our area to do this exact thing that they're doing. And that's the sort of things that, so for people that want to look for diversity of crops and look for young people to come back to rural Minnesota, this is the sort of thing that we want to do. Those two wine bottles that I'm moving around are two of their award-winning bottles of wine, and they produce 100% of the grapes and 100% of the wine on their farm itself. I asked them that, and everything is produced locally. So the reason for my bill, Mr. Chair, is we have this great business, but out in rural country, as you know, you live in rural country, things are off the beaten path. And these farm wineries, where they're growing up, some are on main thoroughfares, but in the case of Hinterland Winery, and there's some others, they are off the road. This one is about just east of Clare City, north of Highway 23, about a half a mile, and they're running into a problem for people, and it's on a township road, so it's not even a main road. They're having difficulty with people identifying where they're supposed to turn and go in to their business. And so they've been spending, Eric has been working about the past year and a half on trying a way to work with signage, either his own private signage or those blue signs that we see that note when there's a place of business in the area. And they kind of fall between the cracks on the law. And I think the laws are good and they're meant to do some things, but with the evolving economy in rural Minnesota, there's sometimes that I think some changes need to be had. I worked for starting last year with Mr. and Mrs. Coonan on a way to identify that we could be successful with the sign. We did work with the local MnDOT. We did talk with MnDOT here in St. Paul. We weren't able to come up with something, so I felt that legislation had to happen. However, I don't want to be casual with legislation. I just didn't want to put in something that kind of created a fix for me but problems for others. So we worked very carefully to make sure this was narrow enough that it didn't have any incidental issues, but it was broad enough that this wasn't just legislation that just basically said that Hinterland Winery could have their own sign. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's really all this does is it has a classification for farm wineries, which is there's a definition of that in statute, and this provides for an opportunity for farm wineries, I believe it's 2 days a week, at least 4 hours per day is what it is. So with that, I stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nora. I have a question for you. Are the Coonans registered lobbyists?
They are not, Mr. Chair. yes, they are. Although, I won't say anything at this point. At this point, my flippancy will get me in trouble, so.
Thank you for that answer. I don't have, Representative South.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to snipe at them. I know we have these blue sign laws all over the place, and I think they're kind of a joke. I just typed them in one of these things, and I think somewhere like approaching 94% of the public is driving around with a cell phone. They popped up immediately, just directly immediately. I also typed in Minnesota wineries, and I'm still waiting for that to render a solution. I would hazard to guess that I know neither of my daughters or families would even think about the signs. If they halfway knew the name of the place, they would go to Google and Google would drive them right there to the thing. I've come to the place where, as an old man, I don't use anything but this when I'm driving. So I'm not certain that we are here with the best and freshest technology with our little blue signs around the state. I was checking mostly that they have registered themselves with Google, which is really the most important step a small business can make today because of the amount of wayfinding that's done through their cell phones. So I just offer that as a general kind of thing. I really don't mean to snipe at people that think the blue signs are important things, because I think you put the point out is that you need signs, you need that kind of stuff too. But I would wager that most of their clients are getting to their winery through this.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Salk. I agree with you, and that's one of the things that we have the advantage of why agritourism is growing. However, they have found with their business that basic signage is required so that people can successfully find they would be actually happy if they could put their own signage out there. But again, due to perfectly good and perfectly understandable MnDOT laws, they're just not able to do one of those. So we look at I call them the blue signs, they're blue and they're signed, but these blue signs as an alternative to at least, they're going to put them not only, it isn't like it's a sign right where their property is, it's a sign heading up to the road, and then they're also anticipating being able to put a sign out by Highway 7. I won't tell you the configuration, but that would make sense. Another thing I should add, Mr. Chair, is there is a fiscal note, but in that fiscal note it identifies really the cost of these signs, which the owner of the business is required to pay for. So there is no cost to the state whatsoever, and should there be any damage or anything like that, it's also the responsibility of the business owner to pay for this. So there is a financial cost to it. That's why the fiscal note, but it's nothing to the state.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll take the other view from Representative Salk. I am a guy who prefers to use the signs, and I think also it's a bit of an issue with distracted driving. You know, it's better when I'm driving, I can see that sign, so that's a bit of an issue. But I think these signs are important in the countryside, and I think that's the point you're making, Representative Miller, that it's larger than, I know this bill is targeted towards this situation, but I would think that we would serve rural Minnesota well by being a little more loose on these signs, and maybe the next session you folks can take a look at that, because there's areas where it partly shows the economic vitality of the region, where a lot of times it's not that apparent, and it also does provide opportunity for increased business out in areas like, I thought your constituents made a good point, there's not a lot out of areas, and they're providing a service that has changed the culture a little bit of the region, I'm sure, and I think the harm of those blue signs are pretty, I don't see a lot of harm with them, but I see a lot of good with them. And so I'm supporting your bill, Representative Miller.
Thank you. Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, I just want to make a comment that I, too, live by the GPS, but I will tell you in certain places I can get 1 hour outside of the Twin Cities, and it doesn't work. So I concur. I need the signs and appreciate having them available.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will third the sign business. If you Google my house, sometimes you'll end up 30 miles north, and maybe I need to do some more computerized or register myself. But more importantly, my brothers had an industry that they were trying to direct semis to pick up hogs, and they ended up having to put the sign a mile away from the turn. And that makes it very difficult for trucks when they're roaming around township roads. And townships are not real crazy about that either. So I think, you know, within reason, we need to think about how signs are available and directions are allowed. So I appreciate this, too.
Thank you, Representative Keel. I just have to add my 2 cents. If you Google my lake home address, you get right there. But if you Google my farm address, you end up about 5 miles away. And I've tried to get it fixed, and I can't seem to find the person that can fix it. So if any of you know how to fix it, let me know. Thank you, Representative Sundin. I think you may have broken the rule. You know, the rule is you can't be funnier than the chair, and I'm afraid you've lost one of your gold stars today. Okay. Representative Miller, any final comments to your bill?
I just ask for your support, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you. I'll renew my motion that House File 3261 be passed to Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. The bill is passed. You're on your way, Representative Miller. Representative Petersburg, House File 3463. Representative Petersburg, I will move House File 3463 be passed to Ways and Means. I see you have an amendment. I assume it's your amendment. You'd like to move that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I can get your indulgence, I have a grammatical correction that needs to be done on this. On line 1.6, model should be changed to make. It was inadvertent. Obviously, model could be anything within a particular brand, whereas make would verify that. So if you would indulge me with that correction, I'd appreciate that. And then I'll remove that amended.
Mr. Burris, the correction.
Mr. Chair and members, so I have on page 1, line 6, delete model and insert make, and that could be incorporated into the amendment.
Thank you. I will, you want to renew your motion for the amendment, Representative Petersburg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I would move amendment H3463A7 as amended.
All those in favor of the amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed by the same sign. Your bill is amended. Representative Petersburg, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we've had 3 bills today already, and we haven't talked about Menlars once, so I thought we would bring that forward here so that we can deal with that. This actually is a bill not intended to point fingers at anything, just to really address the issue of where we're at today, knowing that we have a lot of issues that could be improved as Menlars moves forward. Also, I think there are some benefits in this particular bill that will also be in advance or into the future helpful as well. So there are approximately 12 sections to it, and I'd like to just quickly go over each one of those. The first section, which the amendment actually deals with, has to do with how auto dealers and auto manufacturers work with each other and how promotions work. In regards to a lot of those promotions, they are time sensitive upon the vehicle being sold. With Menlars and the title delays in actually occurring, sometimes the auto manufacturers and the auto dealers have different times in which they believe that the titles may be moved. this chargeback prohibition just says if it's related to Minlars, that the auto manufacturer will still honor the promotions and so forth. And if there are more questions, we can ask about that later. The second section deals with the value determination, in which DVS uses various formulas and so forth for determining the value. Yet the dealer who is selling it kind of knows that value better. This recommends and really suggests that the vehicle owner, or excuse me, the dealer sells it, they need to keep the supporting documentation of what the value of the vehicle is, but that would be used by the Department of Vehicle Services for determining the vehicle value for taxes, etc. as well. Section 3 kind of goes along with the registration, in which you are allowed to prorate the registration based upon the partial year in which the new owner has the car, rather than doing for the full particular year. Similarly to what you might do when you are transferring property, obviously the new owner pays the prorated portion rather than the entire year. And so this just allows for that particular issue. Section 4 deals with when auto dealers may own more than one facility. In other words, if somebody in Owatonna has a dealership, they also have a dealership in Minneapolis and Rochester. This, under current law, in order to move a vehicle from one place to the other, you need to change the title, because obviously it's now titled in another part of the state. This would allow the dealer to just use the one title registration location, so that they don't have to continually move back and forth. And you can understand, when it takes 2 to 3 months to make that transfer from title, it can create a problem in trying to get some of these vehicles sold. Number 5 is something that I know that DVS is working on, and they've been doing some of this with deputy registrars as well. But this really would say DVS needs to provide a particular contact person that can specialize in auto dealer needs for the registrations and license transfers, and so that they have one person they can contact, rather than just getting in line with everybody else and having to wait an hour and a half, 2 hours, and then not being able to address those answers. I think it really helps having somebody that has that expertise at DVS, and so this would really recommends and suggests that they provide one contact person. Section 6 talks about electronic vendors, basically programs that auto dealers and others that interact with the department, if they have electronic program that can give the data to the department the way they need, and the department would have full control over what parameters, how much information is necessary, and so forth. But if an electronic vendor has the ability to do that, this just says that the DVS needs to work with them and allow them access. Number 7, Section 7, excuse me, really refers to late fees. Right now, when an auto dealer sends in transfer paperwork and it takes more than a week or more for the department to actually get it into their system, they're being charged the $2 late fee. And the last I heard, it's upward near $150,000 in the past that has been charged to auto dealers for late fees when they've done all the paperwork necessary. They've actually done it in time, but because of the law, they're being charged for this. This does repeal that late fee for auto dealers. Auto dealers want to get that transfer out there as quickly as possible. They want the title change as quickly as possible. For their own liability's sake, they're not getting it late, and so this does repeal that particular piece. Section 8 has to do with the federal title lookup, and there are 14 reasons granted to various groups for looking up title information. This just asks for 4 of them, which are related directly to the needs of auto dealers. One of them has to do with theft. Obviously, if they're unclear about whether or not somebody owns a vehicle, they would need to know whether or not there has been a theft occurred for that. Also, the second valid reason would be for accuracy of information based upon the title. The third one is for towed vehicles. as you probably know, if you're in an accident and you need to have your car towed, sometimes you tow it to a particular dealership, and the next morning they come and there's this vehicle in their lot. This would give them opportunity to be able to know who that vehicle is owned by. And then, of course, the fourth one is with consent of the owner of the vehicle, so they can get that information. So those are the four rationale reasons why they would be asked to be able to look up through the federal title lookup. Section 9 is something that is kind of a continuation from what we did last year, in which we've given the deputy registrars the ability to make duplicate titles available. I think that is technically coming online this year. This also would allow them, the deputy registrars, to be able to actually create those titles, since they'll have the paperwork, they'll have the paper, they'll have the ability to do so. And since they're the originator of all the data that's collected for the title, it makes sense that this would streamline the process. It would make a lot of headaches go away as well. So this just continues on with that process as well. Section 10 assigns gives the opportunity for auto dealers to have the same rights as a bank in repossession of a vehicle. Obviously, when some owners have to have their vehicle repossessed, they're not always agreeable to follow some of the procedures that are necessary. This gives the auto dealers the same rights as a bank repossession in order to get the title. Otherwise, the repossession occurs, but the title doesn't occur until the owner gives it up, and this gives them the same opportunity as well. Section 11 has to do with when liens on a vehicle are presented both to the auto dealer as well as given away. Oftentimes there are second and third liens on that particular vehicle. This gives the auto dealers the ability to give an affidavit to the lending institution that indeed the lien has been taken care of. It's basically a prima facie facts limited. The banks may or may not choose to use that depending on how their contract is, but at least it gives the bank notice that paperwork and stuff has been done. Again, it's only because of the time lag of title transfers and getting this lien taken care of that has perpetrated this particular section. And the last section has to do with an advisory committee set up of people that are actually using the system. And so you can look at the people that are involved with that. It's Department of Deputy Registrars, it's auto dealers, it's auction house people, representatives, to give a report on how the system is working, not only now but into the future, so that we could continually improve the system and so it doesn't get outdated like the legacy legacy program did. And so this sets up that particular committee with the first report coming, I believe, in February of 2019. So that is the basic premise of the bill, and I will stand for further questions, and I think there are probably a few testifiers would like to talk.
Thank you. It looks like you have one at the table already. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Certainly, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Amber Backus, and I'm the Vice President of Public Affairs of the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association, here representing its 373 franchise new car and truck dealers across Minnesota. And Representative Petersburg gave a very thorough overview of the bill, so I will just be brief and say that after Minlar's launched and we were all experiencing some problems, folks on this committee as well as Representative Rick Hansen approached us and asked if there were things that could be done in terms of policy tweaks to help alleviate some pressure on the system and reduce the title backlog and just help us serve our customers better during this time of transition to the new Minlar system. So we put our heads together with the deputy registrars and came up with some of these things that would just get rid of some unnecessary transactions that use the system, as well as to remove barriers that make it harder for us to serve our customers. And so this is a product of that. I'd be happy to answer any questions about any of the provisions, but I do want to add as well in your packet, there is a letter from the deputy registrars who are supportive of the legislation and think some of these provisions, including the ability to issue titles, would help reduce the backlog and serve all of Minnesotans better.
Thank you, Ms. Backus, for your testimony. As long as you're at the table, we'll take questions. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know who wants to answer this, but I'm curious about what you're doing in Section 2 of the bill, which relates to the base price. How are Minnesotans benefited by allowing the dealers to set the base price as opposed to the manufacturer?
Ms. Backus.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson. This actually doesn't let us set the price. Right now what is happening, though, with the Minlar system is the base value calculator isn't always coming up with the correct calculation for that base value upon which to figure the registration tax. I know F-150s have been a problem where one deputy will enter it and it's one value. Another will enter it as a different value. And the dealer is the one who actually has the paperwork, that Monroney label, that shows you the MSRP for the base price. So this would allow the dealer to enter the base value that upon which the registration tax is based, so it's accurate going forward. We're not over and under collecting from citizens because they have that information handy.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Thank you.
I don't see any other questions for the testifier. Who else would like to testify to this bill? No one? You've done such a good job, Representative Petersburg, of explaining your bill. You've just completely nullified any opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just ask for your support for this bill.
Thank you. I'll renew my motion that House File 3463 be passed to Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. The bill is passed as amended. That's all we got left. We're going to move on to House File 3355. The author is out of town. His substitute is in another committee, but we have the fine services of a MnDOT employee who knows the bill quite well, and I'm going to go ahead and move that House File 3355 be passed to, I believe, to wait.
It depends. It's supposed to go to general register, but if the amendment goes on, it's
going
to be
so I'm going to wait on the finalizing the amendment. Let's hear about the bill, and then we'll take a look at an amendment, and then we'll finalize the motion. To the bill, Mr. Rudin, please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eric Rudin with MnDOT Government Affairs. Section 1 of the bill requires condemnation commissioners to be residents of Minnesota. So when the value of a parcel of land needs to be determined by a court during eminent domain, the court appoints condemnation commissioners. And in the past, we've always required those condemnation commissioners to be residents of Minnesota, but there was a judge recently who said that there was nothing in the statute that required them to be residents of Minnesota, and so that's why we're bringing this forward. Section 2 of the bill eliminates a requirement that the judge in a condemnation case personally inquire about a commissioner's conflict of interest. The commissioners are required to sign an oath that includes the same requirements. And a court recently determined that the commissioners needed to be questioned in person, which delayed the proceedings. Section 3 of the bill allows for a turnback of Highway 54. Turnbacks assign roads to the right system. Roads that can be a lower priority on the trunk highway system are usually a higher priority on the city or county system. So this section of the bill allows about 10.9 miles of Highway 54 to be turned back. Section 4 increases the limit on direct negotiation trunk highway contracts from $150,000 to $250,000. This limit was last raised in 1999, and this proposal will help us shorten the contracting time for small projects, allowing us to be more responsive to urgent projects that are not part of the normal program, and also to try to increase the participation of small businesses. Section 5 clarifies MnDOT's authority to implement Indian employment preferences on construction projects located on or near reservations. And this will address the underrepresentation of Indian employment on construction projects. Both the Federal Highway Administration and the Department of Human Rights set workforce participation goals, and this change will help us to meet those goals. Section 6 modifies Minnesota statutes to provide specific length limits for automobile transporters and allows them to transport cargo or general freight on backhauls. And this is a change we're needing to make to be in conformance with federal law. Section 7 is also a federal conformity issue. This conforms state statute to a change that Congress recently made allowing logging trucks to operate over 80,000 pounds on a small portion of Interstate 35 near Duluth. Section 8 amends a statute that was enacted last year on emergency vehicles. Federal law requires emergency vehicles to follow size and weight restrictions on interstate highways, and so this clarifies that those vehicles are subject to weight restrictions on interstates. Section 9 of the bill gives MnDOT the discretion to waive payment and performance bonds under direct negotiation contracts. The ability to obtain these bonds can be a barrier for small businesses. And so this change, we're hoping, would allow women-owned, veteran-owned, and minority-owned businesses to better compete on MnDOT projects. And this change would only, this authority would only be used on probably about 10 to 12 projects per year. Sections 10 through 16 turn back several portions of trunk highway. Highway 222 turnback is about 1.5 miles in Red Lake County. The Highway 253 turnback in Faribault County is about 6.5 miles. Highway 254 in Faribault County is about 4.5 miles. Highway 277 in Chippewa County is approximately 11 miles. And then the three turnbacks in the city of Faribault, altogether they come to about 2 miles.
Thank you. I have a question on page 3 of the bill, line 3.3. What is a stinger steered combination, and where did the term come from?
Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I could have somebody come down. I might be able to answer that question.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your answer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Laura Rhodes, and I'm the staff attorney in MnDOT's Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations. If you allow me a moment to dig through my folder, I will find the definition for you. Mr. Chair, a stinger-steered automobile transporter is a truck, tractor, semi-trailer where the fifth wheel is located on a drop frame behind the power unit. So it's a very specific kind of configuration of that type of vehicle.
So why is it called stinger-steered?
Mr. Chair, that I do not know.
Neither do I. I'm curious. First one to get figure that out gets a gold star. So.
Because the connection that has to twist itself back in at the V, like these fingers are done getting your bill.
Epson Petersburg says that because the fifth wheel sticks out behind the truck, it looks like the stinger of a bee. Sounds pretty good. Sounds pretty good. All right. Thank you for that. I have no other questions. We do have an amendment, though. Representative Bernardi, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what this amendment does is adds back in the recommendation that MnDOT made to the legislature, and that was to not sunset and to keep the
active transport, non-motorized active transportation committee intact. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, that committee is very important in trying to advise MnDOT and to get the input of people throughout the state of Minnesota. In fact, it has representatives from each of the MnDOT districts, which there are eight districts and a metro district, or eight altogether, one being a metro district. I think that last is correct. Good. Okay, I got a nod. And this is especially important, this committee, because it allows people from across the state to have their voices heard, and especially people from greater Minnesota. They don't always have groups like this that help express the needs of people who walk, people who bike, and use the transportation system. And they get reimbursed for their expenses when they come down to when they meet for these meetings. And when this bill gets passed, let's say MnDOT continues it, they would no longer get reimbursed for their expenses and travel. And, you know, that's like, why hurt the little person when they are very committed to our state, very committed to our transportation system, and offer an important voice, especially from greater Minnesota, who aren't as organized as probably people in the metropolitan area. And the other thing I would... and perhaps I'm not accurate, and I'd be happy to hear about groups across the state that are doing that. That's awesome. So I'm sure that there are some, but possibly not as organized. Maybe I should say it that way. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is, you know, this isn't fluff. We are all, no matter if we use transit or we drive a car ourselves, we all become pedestrians at some point in our trip. And it's important that we make sure that our transportation system is meeting the needs of us in our entire trip and keeping everyone safe. And oftentimes having the voices of Minnesotans to bring in the public input is super important. So anyway, I would like to ask for your support for this amendment.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I urge a no vote to this proposed amendment. I looked up the details of this advisory committee on non-motorized transportation. It looks like it went into law in 2008 or 2009. Went into law in 2009, I think. The mission or the purpose was to establish an advisory committee non-motorized transportation and make recommendations to the commissioner on items related to non-motorized transportation, including safety education and development programs. And then they review issues, etc. And they report back to the legislature members every year annually. So, Mr. Chair and members, so far they've given us 10 reports. As far as I can tell, there's at least 27 or 28 members on this commission. Most of them are members of government. Members, this is nothing, is really kind of devolving into nothing more than a special interest organization sanctioned in statute. We've got hundreds of these special interest organizations littered throughout our statutes. Let's get rid of one and let it expire.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just first of all, a comment. I don't know if we're more organized or less organized in the country, but my wife might suggest I'm a little disorganized sometimes. But I think what you're referring to is there's more, probably more active non-motorized transit organizations in the metropolitan area. I want to thank you for bringing this amendment. And I think it's really in the public interest. This isn't any kind of a private interest. This is a public interest, and I'll just give you, here's some issues that are going on with non-motorized transit in my area right now. They're hot on the button right in my region. I got invited to the St. Peter City Council, and they wanted to make some suggestions for priorities. One of the top priorities, bicycles, okay? We're trying to get a bicycle trail as part of the Minnesota Trail that stretches from Mankato to St. Peter. There's a challenge in getting through private property. The Uniman Corporation has been just fantastic in allowing the trail to go through the Kasota Prairie area, a beautiful area. But there's some obstacles still, but that's another hot issue. the Sakata Trail between Mankato and Faribault is a well-used trail, used by a lot of people. And Representative Daniels, if you've been on that lately, where the ruts are, I just learned yesterday that the bids are going out, and people have been waiting for years for that to be rebuilt. There's the, I could go on. The point is, these issues are important where I live. Mm-hmm. And rural people are using non-motorized transportation. The safe walking to schools is just a key issue for us. We're always applying for that money. Never enough to make sure all our kids can safely walk to schools. I think this is a pretty important rural issue, and so I thank you for bringing the amendment. I hope we can prevail. Thank you.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, my district wishes they had a bike trail. We have a few in the city of Fairmont, one by the city, but we don't have any that go any distance at all. And there's a lot of people wish they had one. I remember when we had another chairman of the Capital Investment Committee, she says, Gunther, where's your bike trail? And I think I also recognize the importance of having bike trails. Non-motorized vehicle trail.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Gunther, for your comments on that. I would like to ask for a roll call.
Thank you. Roll call being requested. Roll call will be taken. We're not quite done with questions, apparently. Representative Gaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, members, an interesting discussion. I think it's kind of lost focus here, though. What we're talking about is whether we should maintain yet another advisory committee that meets regularly and drains on the resources of the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota. Has already delivered 9 or 10 reports, of which every bike trail group in the state has the ability to read and probably, take the advice that has been offered by this commission committee over the last 10 years. I think the committee has outlived its purpose and has become nothing more than a perpetual advisory committee or a perpetual interest group sanctioned by statute. And it's time for us to read the reports we had and let this one expire. Please vote no.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is actually to Mr. Radin, I think, to help us deal with this amendment. The department, is this committee the only committee that you listen to and the department uses to develop its policies in regards to non-motorized activity? Certainly there must be other avenues that you perceive and use, and this doesn't necessarily preclude you from using a committee like this as well. So can you give us a little bit help on how you make policy decisions in regards to non-motorized programs?
Mr. Radin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg. As far as I know, this is the only committee that exists for non-motorized transportation on a statewide basis. Mm-hmm. I think that, for example, in the Metro District, that there's another organization that consults with Metro District staff on bicycle and pedestrian projects. But I think that this is the one that we have for statewide transit, biking and walking projects. There is a Safe Routes to School program, and they have, I believe, they have an advisory committee that helps us select projects for funding through the Safe Routes to School program, but that's obviously limited just to projects that are near schools. As far as what we would do if this wasn't in statute, we've had some discussion about that, and I think we would continue the work of the committee, but as Representative Bernardi pointed out, we would not be able to compensate the non-government members for their expenses, their travel expenses, and so forth for coming to meetings.
Representative Petersburg, give a follow-up.
Well, just a quick question, follow-up if I could, Mr. Chair. Mr. Radin, so what you're telling me is that the department doesn't use any other decision-making processes in regards to non-motorized programs, et cetera, that this is the only one that you use, and so basically you just got to rubber stamp what the committee does, because that seems like you have a lot more input from Metro Mobility and others in regards to do this on a regular basis, and I find it hard to believe that you would only use this committee's recommendations in making those policy decisions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nadine, I wanted to ask a follow-up question regarding, you and I have had some email correspondence in terms of some of the NINSHIP dollars and data provided. And one of the things I asked you for were, how do you get your input and what the questions were? And you told me that you do outreach meetings about the NINSHIP investment categories. Would you consider those outreach meetings similar to the kind of doing some of the kind of work that Representative Drazkowski just noted in his commentary?
Mr. Rudy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barr, yes, when we do a specific statewide multimodal plan update, for example, we would reach out to non-motorized modes and try to get their input. There's also a statewide bicycle plan, and so for things like that, this group would help provide input to those plans, but the outreach is broader than just to this group.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Barr.
But I just want to be clear that in the report that you shared with me, it includes things like bicycle infrastructure and pedestrian type of related things. So in reality, those focus groups or outreach meetings that you're doing is covering some of what is being addressed by this current
Mr. Rudy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barr, I think that's correct, yes.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Rudin, can you say how often you update that NINSHIP document?
Mr. Rudin.
Mr. Chair, I believe that's on a five-year cycle, so every 5 years we're updating that document.
Thank you. A roll call having been requested on the A3 amendment to House File 3335. We will take the roll. Chair votes no. Did I say 3355? That's what I meant to say. House File 3355, the A3 amendment.
Petersburg.
No.
Bornstein.
Yes.
Baker. Barr.
No.
Bernardi.
Yes.
Daniels.
No.
Drazkowski.
No.
Gunther.
Yes.
Hulsman.
Yes.
Howe. Johnson.
Yes.
Keel.
No.
Kosnick. Lucero.
No.
Mason.
Yes.
Miller.
No.
Nelson.
Yes.
Rarick. Rosenthal. Runbeck.
No.
Salk.
Yes.
Sundin.
Yes.
There being 10 nays and 8 ayes, the amendment is not adopted. To the... I'm sorry, we may have a miscalculation, members. We're going to have an instant replay. Thank you. I the number was wrong. The vote was 9-9, but the amendment still fails. The decision is still the same. We will correct the minutes. With that, members, we've got one. We need to finish. Let's finish. Well, we got to finish this bill. I'm not used to not having an author up here. Representative Rudin, which, you know. I'll renew my motion on House File 3355 be passed to Because of the amendment, because the amendment failed, we can pass this to the general register. That's why I hesitated earlier. So the motion is House File 3355 be passed to the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill is passed. Thank you. I don't even know who to thank. Members, we have another bill, and then we'd also have an issue that Representative Mensah brought forward regarding a bridge naming that we would like to do some informational hearing so we can keep it moving. But we need to hear the Nash bill first.
Okay.
So we'll move ahead then to the Nash bill that we laid on that we laid over, and the bill number is 3593. Representative Nash,
we're going to reconsider that.
I move that your bill, House File 3593, be moved to Ways and Means, and I believe we are going to reconsider an amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I believe that amendment is in the packets, I think.
Mr. Burris, to the amendment.
Mr. Chair, members, the amendment was adopted on the March 15th hearing and was the A1 amendment. It had moved a number of the effective dates from 2019 to 2018. It was the H3593A1 amendment.
If you could speak to the amendment. I know members don't have it in front of them.
So, Mr. Chair, members, the date changes in the amendment were to move up what had in the bill as introduced had several delayed effective dates. So a number of the provisions are around reallocation of funds and implementation were delayed to 2019. July 1, 2019, and the amendment had moved that up to be July 1, 2018. Most of the provisions in the bill had that delay and were moved up to 2018.
Thank you, Mr. Burris. Members, any questions? Representative Hausman.
I had a question about the fiscal note. That's probably not affected by the amendment, so I can speak after.
I believe it is affected by the amendment. Representative Hausman, Mr. Lee, can you speak to the impact of this amendment on the fiscal note?
Mr. Chair and members, the fiscal note was prepared to the original engrossment of the bill, so it didn't contemplate the amendment that went on in the last hearing. So by moving that date back again to 2019, it would match the fiscal note that's in front of you.
Mr. Hausman, you are correct that the fiscal note before you is actually reflects the bill without the amendment that was added and with what we're considering
and
right
so
now.
Then my question is really to the chair. We don't yet have targets, and if this goes on to Ways and Means, I mean, is your target affected by you pass this out of your committee and then you don't really have an opportunity to take a look at all the priorities once you get your target?
Right. If we put the amendment, if we amend it as we're considering today, which would put the bill back in its original condition, it's my understanding that, and Mr. Lee, maybe you want to address exactly what the impact is on the current budget process.
Mr. Chair and members, if the committee were to pass this, there would be a $13 million impact in each year in the tails. So the general fund wouldn't be affected for the current biennium with the amendment going out with the effective date going back to 2019, though there would be an impact to the special revenue fund in this biennium. So if you look on the fiscal note, you can see fiscal 2019 that there would be that $7.7 million expenditure in this biennium. But there wouldn't be an expenditure of the general fund in this biennium.
Representative Nash, to the amendment.
not to the amendment, but to the fiscal note eventually, if you'd like me to address
well,
that.
Well, it's all interrelated. Representative Nash, if you care to speak to the issue.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I've read the fiscal note, as have you, and one of the numbers that was just addressed by Mr. Lee was a $7.789 million fiscal note for some programming costs. And members, please look at the fiscal note. It says that that will require 51,886 programming hours. Now, divide that out by 2,080 hours, which is a full-time work year, and you're looking at essentially 24.9 years to program this. It only took 10 years to give us this failed product, and we're going to require twice or 2.5 times that amount to affect the change that we're trying to do. You know, I know we talk a lot about the veracity of fiscal notes, but if ever there was an opportunity to have that discussion, this seems to be one of them, because 24 years to program this change, I call shenanigans, maybe, Mr. Chair. So I think that, well, I'll leave it at that.
Isn't it reimbursement?
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just, so I get my confusion, maybe.
Put your mic down a bit, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the bill we have in front of us, the engrossment, is this the engrossment before or after that amendment was put on? Because it looks to me like the dates are effective date 2019. So is this, was this not engrossed because it didn't leave our committee, or?
Correct. Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, that's correct. It wasn't engrossed because the bill had been amended and then laid over. So it's still in the committee. There was no action of the body and no engrossment resulting from that.
So thank you, Mr. Chair.
So the language before you does not affect the amendment, does not reflect the amendment we're trying to remove.
Correct.
Sorry about that. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Chair, my question for Representative Nash, you're talking about 24 years. Aren't you really talking about 24 people working for a year?
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Johnson. That could be, but essentially we're putting 24 labor years worth of effort towards this, which again I find staggering that this would require that much programming. Again, coming from the IT industry, that is a staggering amount of labor to throw at this. I mean, it's astronomical.
Representative Nash, I think we're going to experience a bit of a rebuttal at the department.
I welcome everybody
to come down
and
testify to this. Again, members, I just remind you, we need to quit on time, and we do want to get to that METSA issue. So please identify yourself for the record, and if you can illuminate our discussion, that would be helpful.
Hi, yes, thank you. For the record, my name is Joan Redwing, and I'm the acting CBTO of DPS. And Representative Nash, Mr. Chair and members, Representative Nash is completely correct that we do expect to have 24 people working on this. Number of the things that we are looking at is we have to modify the ability to expedite requests for driver's licenses, which falls under the FAST product, the driver FAST product. We also have to manage, do an expedite process for title, which falls under the MNLARS product. So our estimate is to bring extra people on both the driver and the MNLARS product. And it's really important to note that because driver is launching in October of 2018, we could not do this in fiscal year 18. We would have to do this in fiscal year 19. FAST does not have the capability to expedite driver's licenses at this time, so they would have to build out that functionality. So we allocated people to do that, as well as people within MNLARS to change fees and build in the expedited title functionality. Also, extensions to finance to be able to process those fees and get those fees all the way back to SWIFT for those expedited fees, as well as changed plate fees that are coming through. So it looks like a simple bill, but this one is a big kahuna for us.
Thank you. I didn't know kahuna was a terminology of programming, but I've learned something today. Members, I'm going to go back to the amendment because I want to get this bill in the shape the author would like. Does everyone understand that the amendment actually puts the bill in the shape that it is in before you? And on that amendment, we will vote now. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. Okay, we have the bill in the shape we would like. We have some more questions, and we have a limited amount of time. Representative Hornstein.
Yes.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Baker.
Very quickly, Mr. Chair. To Ms. Redwing, you're concerned about the expediting process. However, recently you are not allowing deputy registrars to do the expediting process on the motor vehicle side. Is that something that they can help you with if that service is returned to them? So that takes a lot of pressure off of your agency.
Ms. Redwing.
Mr. Chair and members, we have the expedited request on our roadmap and on our prioritized list that the stakeholders have set for us. We are committed to getting the expedited functionality out in the priority order. It did not come out as one of the top 32 items, the high priority items that they want, but it came out kind of in the middle of the pack. So it's not in our... not considered by them an urgent need. We do want them to revisit the prioritization process, reprioritize, and make sure that we're working in the correct order as we recharter our roadmap and our project plan. But we are committed to getting that functionality out for deputy registrars.
Thank you.
Thank you. I will renew the motion that House File 33, I'm on the wrong bill. 3593. I'm having one of those days, folks. Sorry about that. House File 3593 be moved to Ways and Means. All those in favor, as amended. All those in favor, as not as amended.
Where's that line in?
Boy, I do need a rewind button. House File 3593. Be passed to Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. You're on your right, Representative Nash. Representative Hornstein, we're going to talk about this Mensa bill to try and keep it alive. So, yeah.
So
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Mensa wanted me to just let you know about House File 4164. This was passed out of the Transportation Policy and Regional Governance Committee earlier this week. It designates a bridge on Highway 37, goes over Highway 53 in Eveleth as the Specialist Noah Pierce Bridge. In 2007, Army Specialist Noah Pierce took his life. He was 23 years old. He served two tours in Iraq, and he returned with PTSD. And his mother, Cheryl Softich, contacted Representative Mensa about doing a bill in his honor. And she hopes that this is a reminder for people who seek help before making the decision to take their lives. And it would be the first bridge, we think, in the country named after a soldier who had PTSD. And my understanding is that the family would cover the costs of the sign or signage. So that's what Representative Mensa wanted me to share with you.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. I was told the same thing about the cost. And this came to us, you know, at the very last minute, but we're happy to do all we can to keep it alive. The bill will be in our possession, but not until about 3:30 this afternoon. So we hope to move this issue forward. Thank you for bringing it to the committee, Representative Hornstein. With that,
thank
members,
you,
we are adjourned for the day.